Chloe Bash, and I'm a junior history major here at Carleton. Today, I have the distinct pleasure of introducing Cliff Clark, a member of the Carleton faculty who has profoundly shaped this field and this institution. Professor Clark received his BA from Yale, an MA and PhD in American Studies from Harvard, where he subsequently served as a freshman advisor, head resident, and tutor. After teaching at Amherst College from 1967 to 1970, he joined the Carleton faculty as a professor of history and subsequently of American Studies. Throughout his career, Professor Clark has been a major figure in both fields, authoring books and articles ranging from religious beliefs and social reform in the Gilded Age to the Victorian dining room and how it came to be. Here at Carleton, he has directed the American Studies program for 20 years, teaching a variety of courses in history, American Studies, and cross-cultural studies. He has exemplified this institution's commitment to collaboration within the liberal arts in his team teaching to 16 different faculty members from 11 different departments. The students in his A&I, drunks, and teetotalers, have already had the chance to benefit from his expertise, but more of your freshmen may be familiar with Cliff Clark's work than you initially realize. Perhaps you use the American history textbook he co-authored with Paul Boyer, called The Enduring Vision, in your high school classes. Or perhaps you've enjoyed the ecologically minded design of Cassatt and Memo, or found yourself lucky enough to visit the townhouses this last Friday night. Professor Clark served on the design committee for these buildings, as well as those for Weiss and LDC. Today we all have the chance to learn from his 50 years of teaching and scholarship as he offers this A&I convocation entitled My Freshman Year and Yours, Politics, Technological Change, and the Value of the Liberal Arts. Please join me in welcoming Professor Cliff Clark.
Thank you, Chloe. Isn't this a great new screen? And welcome to the refurbished chapel. We have new lighting, and it's going to be not yet, but needed, but it's going to be air conditioned. So I think that will be nice, particularly for those faculty members who sit up there in their robes when it's 95 degrees. It will be a real change. So the video that you've just seen covers the 50s and 60s, the years that I was in college and graduate school, and covers some of the change, the sense of change in the period. When I came to Carleton in 1970, I don't think people realized that teaching from 67 to 70, when you went into class, students would ask you, why did you assign that? What are we doing in this class? How come we have to have that kind of course? I don't really think that what you've come up with here really makes a whole lot of sense. So there was the world of the 1960s that was a changed world, and it was part of the world that started with me half a century ago when I was a freshman in college. So today I'd like to talk a little bit about my freshman year and compare it to your freshman year and give you a little sense of what it was like. And along those lines, I'm wearing the kind of outfit that I would have worn as a freshman in college. Everybody wore a jacket and a tie. When I looked at the Carleton faculty in the 1960s, the history department, everyone in the picture has a suit on. So the world has also changed in other ways. And I should mention that I had two of my kids graduate from Carleton as well, so I have a special relationship with this college. Looking back at my own education, I cannot help but think of Henry David Thoreau's Walden, one of my all-time favorite books. And his comment in the beginning of the book, which is, perhaps these pages are more particularly addressed to poor students. As to the rest of my readers, they will accept such portions as apply to them. I trust that none will stretch the seams in putting on the coat, or it may do good service to whom it fits. I love this comment because it's so ambiguous. So what does he mean by poor students? Financially poor, or weak students, or students simply who are not aware of the environment around them? And what is our coat? Is it the education that we wear? And what does it mean to have it fit? So these are essentially liberal arts kinds of questions because they ask us to reflect on the value of our education, to think about what we learned and why we learned it, and to ask it ourselves, how well does it fit? In other words, how well does it meet our needs in the present? So with that question in mind, let me turn to my freshman year in New Haven. As I imagine you were a couple weeks ago, I was nervous and excited when I arrived on campus. I really didn't know what to expect. So I picked up my room key and headed to my dorm. It was a dorm like Severance. I was on the third floor. It was a quad that had two small, tiny bedrooms with double bunks in each bedroom, and a small living room with a fireplace. And the other two, I had three other roommates. One, fortunately, was a guy that I had had known in high school. And the other two roommates were from a place called Sidwell Friends, which I didn't know much about, but now that Obama's daughters go there, I've heard of the place. When I arrived in my room and opened the door, one of my roommates was hanging out the window. He had his arm around part of the window. In that hand, he had a quart of gin. In his other hand, he had a telephone, and he was talking to his girlfriend in California while he was drinking the gin. Wasn't exactly the beginning of a college career that I had expected, but by the time my parents and my grandparents came to visit at Thanksgiving, the entire top of the mantelpiece was filled with empty gin bottles. And I remember my grandmother walked into the room and looked at the mantelpiece with this kind of, and then she said, "Oh my." Nothing else, just "oh my" kind of thing. Well, as you might expect, I later realized that this roommate was an alcoholic, and he had dropped out of college by my freshman year. Hey, I didn't know what to expect, so that's the way it was. So other than that, I think my freshman week was pretty much like yours. Lots of meetings, lots of placement tests, which I hadn't really anticipated. And I even had to undergo a swimming test, which also I hadn't thought was going to happen. So unlike Carleton, which has always been co-ed, Yale, when I went there, was an entirely male school on the undergraduate level. So there were no meetings about sexual relations. And with 1,000 freshmen in my class, I never did get to meet, I think, more than about half of them. Had a really close circle of friends, but at our 25th reunion, I found out that Dick Cheney had been a member of my class. He had dropped out and gone to the University of Wyoming, but I didn't even know it at Helen was listed in my 25th reunion book. So otherwise, the events of that week were pretty much like the events of your week, with one big exception. And that big exception was, at the end of the week, my roommates and I were driven out to the house of an alumnus in West Haven who was a federal judge. Now, I'm thinking, why are we having a special, separate meeting with a federal judge? So, in order to get you into sort of the thinking that I was having at this period, let me just give you a little background in the period. And one of the things about this period was the beginning of the Cold War. If you hadn't grown up during the Cold War, you wouldn't know anything about duck and cover, which was what we were supposed to do in elementary school. We were supposed to get under our desk and put our hands over our heads in order to prepare for an atom bomb attack. And for those of you who live in Musser and Myers, you will know that those dormitories were built to serve as hospitals in case Minneapolis or St. Paul were hit with an atom bomb. Not that I think it would have done much good to try to get people here, but that at least was part of the view of the period. The Cold War really begins after World War II with the blockade of Berlin, and then it turned, followed a kind of race to develop a new, more powerful hydrogen bomb. The U.S. exploded their first bomb in 1952, but 9 months later, the Russians exploded their own H-bomb. So not surprisingly, one of the fixtures of popular culture when I was growing up was the James Bond series. 1953, Ian Fleming, who had been a British Secret Service agent, wrote his first Bond book. And the world was all about these vicious bad guys who were out to sabotage the world and the handsome hero who was going to save us. On the political level, you think that the political realm today is a little nuts. We had Senator Joseph McCarthy from Wisconsin, something about Wisconsin that produces these people, who publicly attacked, quote, the phonies and queers, along with, quote, the egg-sucking phony liberals who had pervaded the State Department and were giving secrets to the communists. I mean, how else would the communists have gotten a hydrogen bomb 6 months after we got it? So during the 50s, this Cold War competition between the U.S. and Russia developed this massive propaganda campaign, and this was really the second part of my growing up in this period, because it had first to do with containment. And containment, communism needed to be contained, and Russia needed to be contained, but it sort of percolated, the concept of containment percolated really through the rest of our lives. For example, in the 1950s, you saw a little bit of the Playboy advertisement there, we were told that sexuality should be contained within marriage. And the Playboy bunnies that appeared in the magazine were all described like the girl next door. And you knew how they grew up and so on. And so, not surprisingly, in the 50s, here that I was in high school, the rate of marriage surged in America by almost 50%. By the end of the decade, 70% of all U.S. women were married at the age of 24, And what you will find really interesting, nearly a third of all American women in the 1950s had their first child before they reached their 20th birthday. So there is a huge surge in population, the baby boom, that is part of my work as well. So related to this debate over communism was a debate over the American way of life. And as part of that, the communists did a very good job portraying Americans really as being deceptive. They said that Americans celebrated individualism and freedom, but lived in a virtually segregated society where blacks and other minorities were kept in separate places. Now, the interesting thing about the civil rights movement, which later developed, which was that it really started with the federal government trying to respond to the critique of the communists, so that it was clear that Harry Truman, in 1948, desegregated the armed forces. In 1954, the Supreme Court declared separate but equal was no longer allowable. Eventually, what happened was, starting first with blacks themselves, and then with increasing numbers of students thereafter from northern colleges, the civil rights movement began in the South. As I grew up, most American schools in the North were segregated. Of the 1,000 students in my freshman class, there were only 2 African American students, and one of them lived in my own entryway. Even in New York State, where I grew up, the schools were virtually segregated by real estate covenants that kept black Americans from buying houses in certain neighborhoods, and therefore from attending public schools that were associated with those neighborhoods. My father, who was a high school teacher and a wrestling coach outside New York City, tried to integrate his classes and teams, but knew that integration faced resistance, even in our northern town. And in the middle 50s, when the Supreme Court decision passed, 80% of Southerners opposed that decision. So it was a combination of the Cold War and the Civil Rights Movement that lay behind my concerns in my freshman year, and sort of had me thinking of why we went to visit that federal judge. And initially I thought, well, it must have something to do with protest relations or something like that. But at the judge's house, I learned of something that had happened the previous year. During the St. Patrick's Day parade in New Haven, which had a lot of good Irish Catholics, it had snowed. And a bunch of Yale students had gotten the brilliant idea that making snowballs and beaming the local police with them as they guarded the St. Patrick's parade would be a pretty neat thing to do. Didn't quite work out as they suspected. Police charged into the dorm, students were clubbed and arrested in large numbers. And when I got to the judge's house, he said, "Okay, this is your advice if you are arrested in a social protest or simply for being dumb. What should you do if arrested and offered to pay a public fine and be released?" His advice: don't pay it. Get a lawyer. Because if you pay it, it goes on your record, and you thereafter have a criminal record for the rest of your life. If you try to apply for a job, it will show up, and you won't get news to me, and I am a freshman, not knowing really how the world works. And then there was one other factor that shaped my life, and which may give you a chuckle, and that was the role of technology. Scientific research, of course, had been a part of World War II, and the Gordon bomb site had been developed, which made bombing much more accurate, and particularly radar had been used, and underwater radar sonar had been developed. As an aside, a couple of weeks ago, scholars noted that the invention of sonar underwater radar initially used to spot enemy submarines had transformed in the last half century fishing in America, so that in fact commercial fishing today has become so efficient using that radar that many of the world's major fish species, such as cod and the magnificent bluefin tuna, have almost been wiped out. At the time, these inventions seemed to affirm the American belief that we were simply the most advanced technological society on the planet. And in fact, an enthusiastic writer in the 1940s, after the invention of the antibiotic erythromycin, had argued and suggested that someday, because of the antibiotic use, Americans would be free of all diseases. Similarly, when Russian and American scientists got together for the International Physical Year in 1958 to collaborate on questions of worldwide weather, oceanography, seismology, and solar activity, some commentators suggested that scientists, because they were naturally objective and rational, would be able to solve the Cold War itself. Now, the difficulty with this belief was in October of 1957, my junior year in high school, the Russians launched the first space capsule, Sputnik, which was followed shortly thereafter by launching, you saw the picture of it on the video, of the dog into space, which they then brought back. What made matters even worse than the fact that the Russians did it first was that the U.S. quickly thereafter, several months later, launched, or tried to launch, a Vanguard missile. With millions of people watching on TV, the missile went up 6 feet, exploded in the air. So given the fact that the Russians had a hydrogen bomb and an intercontinental ballistic missile, the idea that Americans were world leaders in technology just didn't seem to work very well. So I was dimly aware of it at the time, but it turned out to have an amazing impact on American education. Congress, the next few years, doubled funds for missile development, passed the National Defense Education Act to improve the teaching of science and mathematics and foreign languages, and started providing all sorts of funds for scientists, so that by 1960, my sophomore year, of nearly a third of scientists and engineers at university facilities nationwide worked full-time on government research, primarily defense projects. And the amount of money that got pumped into the American economy was absolutely staggering. By 1980, the National Fox Science Foundation alone was spending $1 billion a year on higher education. And as a result, sort of supported by all this government funding, while I was in college, schools expanded dramatically. Carleton itself grew from 1,000 students in 1958 1880, to 1,500 students in 1970, to 1,800 students in 1980, and this energized higher education. So, yet these sort of developments that I wasn't really totally aware of, the Cold War and the Civil Rights and the growth of technology were really important as I started my freshman year. So what did I do? I enrolled as a good freshman in calculus and physics, because of the Civil Rights Movement, because of my sophomore year, I had become interested in American history and civil rights, and had shifted my classes to history, English, and economics. Still, technology was important, so let me give you an idea of my technology in 1959, where you have flat-screen televisions, computers, iPhones, iWatches, tablets, a wide variety of internet technologies. My world was restricted largely to typewriters, radios, and vinyl records. I did have an electric typewriter when I went to college. I only had one problem. I did not know how to type. So Yale provided remedial typing classes for their freshmen. And in addition to my regular courses, I took a remedial typing class. So when I came to Carleton in 1970, the history department was so advanced that the chair of the history department, who I think is in the audience today, boasted that all the department needed, besides books and, of course, extra books that were reserved in the library, was yellow pads, pencils, and chalkboards. My level of technology was sort of rather lower than your level of technology is today. So my guess is that most of you, if I ask you, well, if these factors influence my background as a freshman, what has influenced your background as a freshman? You think back over the things that happened when you were in high school. What kinds of things that would you remember or would you know about? The first, I think, might be the rise of terrorism and the attack on the World Trade Center, but certainly the Boston Marathon bombings would be something. Also, you probably would be thinking about other events such as the shootings of students at various high schools around the country, or as recently as the killings of the 9 black parishioners in the church in Charleston, South Carolina. If you're following the news this year, I think you maybe would focus on the cyber attacks, first on U.S. companies like Target, and then on the federal government, including this past spring, the theft of 20 million personal records of federal government employees, or maybe you have read the paper in the last couple of weeks where they're talking about how not only were the complete records of these employees stolen, but also their fingerprints were also taken. So you might also think about the ongoing troubles in Iran, Iraq, and Afghanistan, the rise of terrorism of the Taliban, which in many ways echoed my generation's frustrations with the wars in Korea and Vietnam. But it also echoes another theme that was part of my growing up, which I'll just mention briefly as well. And that was the series of books and movies that appeared in the 40s and 50s, worried about the rise of totalitarianism that had emerged with Hitler in the 1930s, and the fears that it might reemerge in the 1950s. In high school, I read George Orwell's 1984 novel set in the future, where in a world where television cameras are ubiquitous and that where people are watched whatever they do, and where the party brainwashes people and students through a mandatory daily 2 minutes of hate. And although a young couple named O'Brien and Julia try to rebel against the system, they are brainwashed until they recant and love Big Brother, which is the euphemistic name for the political party. So in the public media in the 50s and 60s, this theme of loss of freedom and independence and brainwashing takes a lot of different forms. One I remember very clearly was the 1962 movie The Manchurian Candidate, starring Frank Sinatra, who played an American soldier who was captured, brainwashed, and was programmed when shown the Jack of Diamonds to kill the American president. Today, I think the extraordinary equivalent fears center on the power of private business and the federal government, as well as China and Russia, to collect data and monitor every part of our lives. Companies like Target and Google can not only track our every purchase and exactly where we spend our time, as well as every site we visit online, they can even tell what our heartbeats are with the iPhone and the iWatch, and they can monitor where you've gone today, what you've looked at on your computer, and you know how they show that little advertisement? If you look by a book, it will reappear four times over the next month, and you'll see the same picture again and again. Or perhaps the one I like recently from last week, the Allstate insurance executive, who said that the insurance company had patented a new technology that would use sensors and cameras in cars to collect information on whether the driver is fatigued, inebriated, or whether he or she is texting or listening to very loud music. It would even collect information on nearby cars and what their passengers were doing. As the Allstate executive Tom Wilson said, quote, "There are a lot of people monetizing data today. Searching Google, for example, quote, seems like it's free, but it's not free. You're giving them your information, and they sell your information." So this is part of the world today, your world today, that echoes my world in the 1950s. And there are equivalent fears about the power of the media to indoctrinate innocent young minds, where social scientists in my generation fear brainwashing from communist agents. Public concern today is expressed about web-based terrorist groups who are indoctrinating young adults to go to the Middle East to fight for ISIS or Al-Qaeda. Just last week, number of Somali immigrants in Minnesota pleaded guilty to having been recruited to go back and fight by just the same means. So what concerns me most today is it is difficult to tell how aware your generation is about these kinds of issues. My generation worried about them and didn't do a whole lot about them. Your generation sometimes to me not to think about them, and particularly not to worry about them. So while my generation tended to be rather optimistic about the future, but recognized that deep concerns about nuclear war lay just below the surface, what is the outlook of your generation? Clearly, you have benefited from an explosion of new technology, But you are faced with an overload of information. Where my generation was rather naive about science and the fact that science could solve all the world's problems. it's now clear, for example, that my generation's faith in antibiotics has been proven wrong. Instead of wiping out all diseases, antibiotics has essentially allowed the bacteria to become resistant. And so now we have a new series of diseases which are totally antibiotic resistant. Similarly, the rise of the environmental movement has made Americans aware of just how harmful chemicals can be as cancer-causing agents. So going back to my original question and the quotation from Thoreau about what has the explosive growth of the new technology to do with the liberal arts, and how useful are the liberal arts themselves? Let me ask, how much can we really generalize about the impact of technology on the liberal arts today? Does it help us gain knowledge? What do we learn from it in terms of deciding such things as what to major in college and what career path to pursue when we leave? These are big questions that you will explore and can explore in the future in more depth when you go back to your AI seminars. But as a starting point for thinking about them, I'd like to look just briefly at what we've learned from the massive open online courses, the MOOCs. 3 years ago, Harvard and MIT set up a multi-million-dollar online project which drew more than 2 million participants. It was free, and they could learn online a whole variety of college and university courses. This last year, they did a kind of analysis of what happened. So they found out, for one thing, that of all the 2 million people who signed up for these courses, only 8% earned a certificate of completion. And the computer scientists will be interested to know, only 1% completed the computer science courses. Moreover, and this is really interesting, they also learned that from the people who completed their surveys, that 39% of the people who did, of that 8%, who did complete the courses, were students who had previously taken courses in those subject areas or graduated from college. So the results are pretty clear. It shows that if you want to move on in higher education and learn things on your own, it really, really helps to have some sort of background that you can build on from your liberal arts education at places like Carleton. And the other thing that they learned was that the real value of the liberal arts is not just the range of disciplines that you will study in places like Carleton. It's the importance of the setting in which you study these courses. The Harvard Business School has, in their typical fashion, developed some new courses that are available for pay. In fact, they have one introduction to the basics of business that is a for-pay course that is open to students of liberal arts colleges like Carleton, Amherst, and Williams. And you can find out about it if you're interested in the career set. But what has the Harvard Business School done? They've gone to places, small liberal arts colleges, where they know that students have studied with their friends to develop a basic background that they can use as a foundation in moving on in subject areas. So studying liberal arts in a residential setting clearly makes a huge difference. At Carleton, you will develop the close friendships with your classmates, which will enable you to develop those arguments in depth and sophistication, in far greater depth and sophistication than you could have developed them if you had simply studied alone. These friendships will also continue even after you graduate. Since I teach courses from the Civil War, I have to invoke Abraham Lincoln's view. They will tie you to this place with the term that he used in his first inaugural address, with mystic cords of memory. Love that phrase. At Carleton, in other words, you will learn how to learn. By mastering the tools of different disciplines, you'll also be able to see the limitations of those disciplines. As a Swarthmore College professor of social theory and social action, Barry Swartz, has suggested, to see the limitations of discipline, any discipline, requires a perspective developed at least partially outside that discipline. So studying the liberal arts will also make you more self-aware. And by self-aware, I mean it will mean that you will be forced in some ways with sessions like this to give some thought about what kind of person you are. Are you a listener or are you a talker? What values do you prize? Are honesty, fair-mindedness, courage, and perseverance important to you? Should you get yourself involved in social protests? And of course, what long and short-term goals do you set for yourself? And of course, all of this refers back to Henry David Thoreau's question about how well does your current education fit your own social and personal interests? Ultimately, a liberal arts education not only develops the thinking and reasoning skills needed to solve complex problems, it will also transform you as the learner into a person who can develop the innovative learning strategies that will be necessary to solve the many unforeseen problems that will necessarily arise in the fast-changing world of the future. So what am I parting off observation on my freshman year and your freshman year? Well, it would be this. My guess is that 50 years from now, like me, you will look back with a sense of amazement at the way the world has changed since your freshman year in college. Like me, you may be surprised by the extent that your life has been shaped by national and international issues about which, while in college, you're only kind of vaguely aware. Like me too, you will find that keeping up with technological change and the shifting base of knowledge itself, whether in your area of specialization or in the wider world, will remain vitally important to your economic success and your vital happiness. Learning how to learn, in other words, will be key to your navigation of the future. By immersing yourself in the different approaches taken in different disciplines here at Carleton, you will have built a foundation on which your further knowledge can be expanded. Years from now, when you return to your 25th and 50th class reunions, you will reconnect with your close friends just as if they had just graduated. And you will find that the friendships you will form here this year at Carleton will last a lifetime. No one has a crystal ball that will predict what will happen in the future. Changes that will occur will be totally unforeseeable. But I am confident that your education in liberal arts here at Carleton will give you the tools and confidence to continue to learn, no matter how difficult the material. And should you ever get arrested in a social protest movement, you will now know what to do. Thank you.